political talk is over. At the end of this fight, there will be a new world champion. Will it be Chris Collard? Will it be Steve Skavork?
Second round in there, I've got my jaw broken. I fought with a broken jaw right to the end, and I beat him on points. A great thing at the end of it was Lionel Rose actually put the world title around me.
Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
And welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk.
G'day, Tim.
Now, Ben, picture this. Mm-hmm. You're in jail. You've just had your 18th birthday in jail. You have never previously participated in this sport. What's the probability that 5 years from that point you'll be a world champion?
Pretty low.
That's our guest today.
Awesome. We met Chris Collard through Mark Walling, who we spoke to a couple of weeks ago. Mark, as we discussed, does some work down at the Police Citizens Youth Club in Hamilton Hill, just outside Fremantle in Western Australia. And in particular, he runs a boxing gym with predominantly underprivileged kids. Many of them are Indigenous. Now, Mark is absolutely blessed to have Chris working alongside him. And we'll talk with Chris about the importance of being a role model and the importance of the work he does through that boxing gym. But Chris, without a doubt, serves as this incredible inspirational figure for the kids in that gym.
70 pro fights. What's the one thing you shouldn't do with a pro fighter that's had 70 fights and holds a world championship belt?
You should probably not get in the ring with him.
What did you do?
I got in the ring with him. I got punched a lot. In lots of places. My ribs were quite tender for a number of days. But I know Chris was going easy on me. He was extremely gentlemanly in terms of letting me have a go. And, you know, part of it for me was facing a bit of fear and a bit of a test in that that boxing ring where there is no hiding, there is no escaping. And so, I certainly faced some fears. And I think the judges would have said it was a draw.
Split decision.
Split rib. It was about the only thing that was split. But Chris, clearly a champion inside the ring, but a champion outside the ring as well in terms of his attitude, what he's giving back, and the way he's doing it.
World champion at the age of 23, kickboxing, mm-hmm. then into boxing, into mixed martial arts. But this is not just a story of combat sports.
No, it very much is a story of discipline. It's a story of what you can achieve. The fact that no matter, you know, you painted that circumstance, the background that he came from, and his overcoming that and achieving what he has is inspirational to everyone.
Story of inspiration, I agree. Well, let's hear it. Let's get on with the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Tim.
G'day, Ben.
And Tim, we've got a pretty special guest with us today. Now, to set a bit of scene, Chris, last time we met, you punched me so hard and so often in the head that I could read the brand of my headgear for about a week. So if I come across a bit sort of gun-shy in this conversation, I'm just trying to avoid a repeat.
Now, in contrast, Chris, you didn't land a punch on me at all. And that's the truth.
We can probably go into that a bit later on. But mate, welcome. Thank you very much for coming along. And could we start, maybe, by just providing a bit of your background? How did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, well, it all sort of started when I first went and done some boxing at PCYC. In Coburn, my trainer was Wayne Barwick, and I trained up about 3 months, 4 months for an amateur boxing fight, and I had a bit of taste of just sparring mm-hmm. and the exercise, and I trained up for this belt, and I actually went through with it. I went to Mandra. It was my first boxing fight, and I fought another Aboriginal guy, Max Kelly. And mate, like before the fight, my knees were knocking. I was like so nervous. I was petrified because I've never sort of encountered sort of that sort of side of it as well. And I thought, shit, man, Chris, I'm here. Just have a crack at it. So you know, I put all the nerves aside and jumped in there. And then I had my first amateur bout with this Aboriginal fella and went the distance and just beat him on points. So that was the start of sort of a big sort of career that I had.
So isn't that a great metaphor? Just have a crack at it.
Yeah.
Great metaphor. Can we rewind a little bit?
Exactly.
With your indulgence, Ben. Talk about your upbringing a little. Because there was a bit of a journey that saw you finally arrive in PCYC to learn boxing. Could we just talk about that? Yeah.
I pretty much come from a broken home, and there was a lot of alcohol, there was a lot of physical abuse, verbal abuse, and you know, it wasn't a real stable sort of upbringing that I had. So I pretty much had no role models in my life, and you know, I was in and out of institutions from the age of 13 right up until I was 18, you know, the likes of Longmore, Riverbank, and, you know, it was the hard knock school, basically. And, you know, all the people that I hung around with back then were, you know, like on drugs, they were committing crimes, you know, just petty crimes, stealing cars, you know, the you know, burgs and all that sort of stuff that was involved in my life at that point of time, because I didn't have anyone to look up to in my family. So I found that love and, you know, that camaraderie out there with other Aboriginal guys that were, you know, doing crime and doing the wrong thing. And, yeah, and then I sort of ended up doing some time in Longmore, Riverbank. And once I got released from Riverbank, when I was in custody, I had a long, hard look at myself, because I'd done a lot of solitary confinement in there, and, you know, I was just bucking against the system. I wasn't going with it, because I didn't like to be, you know, held in prison. You know, the security was, like, full on, and I was, you know, going against the grain. And yeah, well, I had a deep, hard look at myself, and then I thought, man, Chris, you know, I've got to change. And if I don't now, I'm going to end up, you know, dead on drugs or institutionalized for the rest of my life. So when I got out of Riverbank, I trained up for that first amateur boxing fight, and I thought, man, after that fight, I've got some talent, you know, like, you know, I felt good about myself because, you know, I won a fight, and because I never got that support from home. So I found it within myself. And, you know, a lot of the trainers that I met on my journey through my career were like father figures. They were role models. And, you know, the people that I hung around were positive people. So that's what sort of set me on the straight and narrow, because I learned so many positive things from these positive people that I hung around with, and they gave me a good direction and path in life to go in.
Let's talk about your professional record, just to set the scene. How many fights have you had, and what's the win-loss ratio of different types?
Yeah. I've had about 70 professional fights. Kickboxing, Muay Thai, and pro boxing. I've had 22 pro boxing fights. I was 3 times Victorian middleweight boxing champion. I fought for a World Boxing Federation title, and I had more wins than losses in my boxing career. I can't sort of remember how many wins and, you know, how many losses, but I think it was more wins than losses. And my kickboxing Muay Thai career, that was more wins than more losses. I've just got to, because I've never sort of documented all my...
Put down the stats.
Yeah, that's right, the stats and all that sort of jazz. But yeah, with that side of it, coming from a broken home and, you know, facing a bleak future, I sort of met a lot of people, and I got to travel to like cool countries. Like I lived in Japan for 6 months. I lived in Thailand. I fought in Czechoslovakia, Prague, Hong Kong, Macau. So, you know, from coming from where I did to actually reaching them particular milestones in my fighting career was just a blessing in disguise.
So let's fill in some of those gaps. You mentioned a lot of time in juvie as a kid, and I think you spent your 18th birthday in Riverbank. Yeah. And you got out, found the PCYC, and obviously, I mean, you've had to work hard to get to that first fight, yeah? So would you say that's the first like thing you've really focused on? Was that, it was like a calling for you?
Yeah. Because with the Aboriginal community and in my family, like my family were a line of like tent fighters and, you know, boxers and all that sort of stuff. So that sort of blood run in my veins and, you know, that was my calling and I felt it, you know, I felt that sort of connection. This is, you know, what I feel comfortable with. And I was like, The ring was my second home. I felt like, man, this is where I should be.
What I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, absolutely so.
So you have your first fight. You win on points. It opens up this, you know, as you said, you got some talent. You felt good. Where did you go from there?
Yeah, from there, because I had a friend got in my ear when I was younger, and he goes, oh, come over to Connor, BJC, Muay Thai, gym is over there, and, you know, come over there and train. And I sort of was really fascinated with the Van Dams and the Bruce Lees and the Chuck Norrises back when I was young. And I was like,
as we all were.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who wasn't kicking and punching their cupboard?
Absolutely, yeah.
I think Chris was probably doing it a lot better than you or I, mate.
Yeah, so I ventured over to BJC and had some fights there. And, you know, I had like 3 fights in one night with them. And, you know, I had like about 5-6 fights with them guys. And, you know, my win ratio was like a lot higher than my loss. I think I had 1 loss out of like 5 fights that I had with BJC. And then, like, I was told that Melbourne was the place and, you know, the career for kickboxing and fighting, because you've got Sydney and Melbourne and, you know, everything's central to them 2 places. So I went over there and followed my dreams, and I wanted to, like, pursue a bigger career in fighting. And at that point in time as well, I was looking for apprenticeship as a bricklayer in Perth, but I was, like, looking around, couldn't find one. And I think the economy was really bad then. So then I moved over to Melbourne. I got an apprenticeship as a bricklayer. And I've been a bricklayer for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kept me on the straight and narrow and, you know, disciplined. And it's been good to me.
So just slowing things down a little bit. You had your 18th birthday inside the juvenile justice system. By the age of 23, you're in Melbourne. And you had a shot at a world middleweight kickboxing title. Slowing it down, what do you remember about that night in 1999 at the age of 23, standing up against a Croatian contender at Collingwood Town Hall in Melbourne? What do you remember before the fight? How were you feeling?
Well, I had these 2 fellas that were like doing a documentary on me, and they followed me around, you know, for like a couple of weeks, just to sort of film, you know, my training, you know, outside of training, my personal life, and all that sort of stuff. So there was a bit of pressure on me because of that side of it as well, and you know, I sort of went into this world title fight thinking, man, well, Chris, you know, this is what my whole life's equal to, you know, this is the end product. So, you know, all the years of training and all the sacrifice, you know, cutting weight and, you know, all the commitment that I actually made to my fighting career, I thought, Chris, well, you know, this is your time, you know. And on that particular night, sort of, I hit, you know, the second gear and the straps just went up, and, you know, it was an awesome fight. And this kid, Steve Skovic, he was a tough kid, you know. I punched him, I dropped him, I kicked him, I dropped him, you know, he just kept on coming up.
First round, he's dropped Skivort, he's dropped Skivort. Well, the Aboriginal warrior on fire here in the first round. He won. Oh, the big right hand! The big right hand! He planted him like a tree. Chris Collard pulling out all the stops in the first round. Overhand right by Collard. He's on a demolition mission.
Like, he was hard as nails, and he come from that worn, torn, you know, country, Croatia. So they're tough there. They beat him tough.
Chris Collard, what a big left hand. He rocks Skivork's head back. Skivork's in a world of hurt early on. Well, certainly one focused man is Chris Collard.
He was a worthy advocate of my world title fight. So, yeah, it was tough because my second round... in there, I got my jaw broken. He broke my jaw the second round. I fought with a broken jaw right to the end, and I beat him on points. And
big, thunderous overhand right from Collard, and a short right hand. A couple of body shots. Digs away the left of the ribs. My word, that's it, that's it. It's all over. I believe we have a new champion of the world, and his name is the Aboriginal warrior, Chris Collard. We await the judge's decision, but I'm sure Aboriginal world champion.
Well, this is the decision everyone's waiting to hear.
And brand new junior middleweight champion of the world.
A great thing at the end of it was Lionel Rose actually put the world title around me, and you know, he was a Aboriginal that won a world title in Japan, and you know, it was just a great moment of my life to, you know, ever think that, you know, I would ever, you know, get to that stage in my life, because, you know, like a lot of my friends in the past were institutionalized. I could have been down that road, or I could have been, you know, not on this earth. It could have been, you know, two of the things that I would have been facing if I didn't get out and make that move to Melbourne.
How did you feel when he was putting the belt around your waist?
Oh, it was just a great feeling, just a feeling that it's hard to explain, you know, because... it's not an opportunity that you get every day, but, you know, the end product was just so satisfying, and, you know, everything that I've, you know, done through my life, it come down to this moment, and it was just an exhilarating feeling. It's hard to put an actual word on the feeling I got from it.
History in the making of the Collingwood Town Hall. Scenes of jubilation, pandemonium in centre ring. We have a new world champion, and his name is Chris Collard. From myself,
we've spoken to a lot of people who've done some pretty amazing stuff, and something I'm fascinated in is how people deal with setbacks, you know, how they just keep going towards that goal. You get your jaw broken in the second round. Did you knew it? You knew it had gone when he landed it.
Yeah, absolutely. It just felt like it was out of whack, and I could feel like something was going on. But it's just like when you're in that moment, you know, you've got to put the pain, you've got to put everything to one side, because, you know, this is a world title, you know, shot. I come from Perth, WA, you know, I come from a broken home. So I thought, you know, everything that I've got, it's got to equal at this minute. And if it doesn't, you're not going to get this, you know, title. Yep. So, you know, I had to put everything to the side and just, you know, focus on the end picture. And yeah.
Was there any point in that fight you thought you couldn't do it? Did you ever doubt yourself?
No, I believed in myself, because, you know, I'd done the preparation, I'd done the hard work, you know. So, you know, you do the hard work out of the ring, you know, the fight does become easier, because you've committed to, you know, being fit, you know, mentally prepared. So, yeah, it's just the end product, getting the title and getting the win.
Boxing, kickboxing, it's a journey of pain. How do you work through that pain, whether it's broken jaw or in another fight you fought with broken ribs? Every training session there's some degree, some high level of pain. How do you work through those pain barriers?
Yeah, it's just one of them things where you have to be strong, and you know, over the journey of your fighting career, you know, your body gets conditioned, your mind gets conditioned, you get weathered to any condition that's thrown at you.
So that belt, that world champion's belt, where's that now?
That's at home collecting dust.
Do you ever look at it and just think how far you have come from the age of 18 through to that moment, 23, Lionel Rose putting it around your waist to now? And incidentally, still fighting at the age of 46?
I just don't look at it as much because, like, I come from humble beginnings, so I don't know. It's just one of them things that, you know, I done, I achieved, and, you know, I've got a beautiful wife now. I've got, you know, five kids, so, you know, they sort of take a lot of time up, and I just put back into my family, and, you know, I'm helping in the community at a boxing gym, you know, PCYC, so I'm putting back into the community, so I don't sort of reflect a great deal back into the past, but when I do, I'm just so blessed that I'm in this position. I've got a beautiful wife, I've got beautiful kids, and, you know, and I've got good people around me, and that's what sort of makes me, you know, happy to be on this earth breathing.
So at that time, you've got the world championship, you've got the belt around your waist. Did life change for you then?
Yeah, it did change for me. It actually opened up a lot of doors because in Melbourne there's a lot of opportunities over there, and I'd done some modelling, I'd done like television commercials, and, you know, I was on like a big poster that was on NAB Bank in every sort of state. So yeah, it opened up other doors. But the sad thing about kickboxing, it's not like it's AFL or rugby league, and there's no money behind it. So, you know, when I was in actually Japan, like, people recognised me, you know. I was like signing autographs, and, you know, people, like, women would come up to me, give me flowers, and you know, just everyone would know you, because, like, over there, fighting is a different kettle of fish. Here, like, this sort of fighting isn't recognised, you know, like, you know, the AFLs or the rugbys and, you know, the other sport. But, you know, the good thing about UFC, it's come so far in a short amount of time, and it's really put, like, fighting on the Richter scale. So it's good in a sense that that's happening, because a lot of people, you know about UFC fighters, and, you know, it's good that the community's embracing it.
Yeah. So you've mentioned a couple of different places that you lived. You spent some time in Koh Samui in Thailand, in a camp there. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was a Westerner camp, basically. So a lot of Westerners could go there and train, but, you know, you had to train sort of really hard. You know, there wasn't no slacking off, because we had a lot of Thai trainers there. There was a lot of Westerners there. So you could actually, you know, go out and, you know, eat some food and enjoy yourself and, you know, go to nightclubs and party. But at the end of the day, you had to sort of commit to the hard training. And I was over there under sort of a great sort of guy that had a lot of contacts in Thailand throughout the world. And he got me fights in Czechoslovakia and Prague as well. So he was like great in the sense where if you committed to your training and he seen that you were putting in the hard yards, he'd get you the fights all over, you know, the world. And he said to me, Chris, you know, if you come back, I'll get you a shot at a WMCT title. So that was a world Muay Thai title. But, you know, I come back to Australia, I injured my knee in football, and sort of my career sort of stopped from Muay Thai kickboxing, and I converted to boxing, and yeah, that's another story.
Well, let's hear it. So you, knees out, the kick side of the kickboxing's but he'd taken a hit, gone into boxing. Where did that take you?
Yeah, it was great, because when I first started, like, my money management wasn't sort of all that great. Like, I was, you know, thrown in with Tigers. Like, I should have sort of been built up the confidence and basically had a good sort of foundation to get me confident, get my skills right, because when you come from Muay Thai kickboxing into boxing, you're having to learn how to walk again, basically, because the stance is different, everything, you know, the head movement, the hands, keeping up your hands, everything's a lot different. So, you know, I should have been sort of put in a situation where I, you know, had some easy fights, got some confidence up, you know, got the skills up, and then progressed to harder fights. But I was like fighting guys that, you know, was in the Commonwealth Games, that, you know, won silver medals, and these guys were tigers. I was going in there, you know, I'd last three rounds with them, TKO and all that sort of stuff. So that's what happened in my boxing career. So I had a few losses when I first started, and then sort of I started getting good, and I started getting the confidence. My wins started coming up, and then I fought for a Victorian middleweight title on Foxtel against Adam Ledevers. And, you know, he was a tough guy, and I caught him with an overhand right, knocked him out in Foxtel, won the Victorian title. So then sort of things changed for me. You know, it was great with the win and the confidence. And then it sort of opened up other doors to fight for a World Boxing Federation title and all that sort of stuff.
In those early days of the crossover from Muay Thai into boxing, did you ever sort of forget and throw in a cheeky knee or an elbow?
No, the funny thing is I was really sort of disciplined, so I didn't do that. Yeah, because like you got boots on it, and you know that, you know, you got the different outfit on for the different occasions. So
So trainer Don Miller said that you were one of the toughest and hardest fighters he's ever come across. He also said that if you had an enormous heart and if you showed a bit more commitment and dedication to training, you could be absolutely anything. Reflections on that? Interesting contrast?
Yeah, because back in the day, living in Melbourne, you know, you're caught up with, you know, the nightlife. There's a lot of nightclubs, and when you're sort of knowing you can get into nightclubs for free, and you sort of opens doors to, you know, live the good life. And I sort of started partying a bit too hard, and, you know, not sort of committing to my fighting life fully.
Now, you also wore an Australian jersey, metaphorically speaking. You fought for Australia in the King's Cup.
Yeah.
What's the King's Cup?
I represented Australia in the Asian Games, basically. So different people from different parts of the world come to fight in the Asian Games. It's like, you know, boxing, the Commonwealth Games, you know, and you fight for medals, basically. And you've got elbow guards, you've got shin guards, you've got head guards, so you've got the full kit and caboodle on.
And out of boxing, and now you're preparing for a mixed martial arts fight at the age of 46, which is incredible. And you are in 44. Jeez.
Tim trying to make himself feel a bit more excited.
44. Why? Why at the age of 44 do you want to take mixed martial art fights?
Because I feel as though I've still got something to offer. And basically, you know, It's for the younger generation, you know, especially the Indigenous generation. You know, I want to sort of be a spokesperson, a role model to, you know, the Indigenous, the non-Indigenous people that come from broken homes, less fortunate backgrounds than, you know, the average person. And I want them to see me in the eyes where this guy, you know, it doesn't matter what age, what boundaries that is in front of him, he still will have a crack at whatever he sets his mind to doing. And that's what I want the younger generation to do, especially the Indigenous people, you know. Once you set your mind to it, you've got to, you know, go out and, you know, sacrifice a lot of things and make that commitment and dedication to, you know, getting the rewards at the end of the day. And you know, this is another stage in my life where, you know, age is no barrier. I want to have a crack. I'm doing okay. So I just, you know, want to let the Indigenous community know and the non-Indigenous community out there that, you know, age is no boundaries. Have a go. And, yeah.
So mixed martial arts, a different style of fighting. You've come out of kickboxing into boxing, now into MMA. How are you adapting to the changes of that style of fighting?
Yeah, I've struggled with the Brazilian jiu-jitsu side of it, the ground stuff, but like I've been doing it for a while, so it's all sort of, you know, falling into place and I'm starting to sort of get it sorted. But yeah, it's a different sort of fitness, and, you know, you've got to know, you know, the techniques, and, you know, there's all different things behind getting it all sorted. But, you know, it's a slow process and it's all coming together for me.
and you're on the card for a fight in September. Do you know who you're fighting?
No, not as yet, but that will probably be released later on.
So you mentioned before the importance of to you of being a role model and of showing people, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, you know, that age is no barrier, that you can set your mind to something. You do that largely through the PCYC, Police Citizens Youth Club?
Yeah, I do it for them, but like I'd love to be able to sort of do a lot of public speaking and yep. mentoring, because when I was living in Victoria, like throughout my whole career over there, they would like send me to Mildura, to Swan Hill, and yep. would go to different sort of areas, like speaking to kids. And there was like a diverse lineup of athletes, footy players, heptathletes, you know, golfers, cricketers, and you know, I got to sort of mingle and meet a lot of different people, like the likes of Kyle Vanderkuyt, and yep. you know, Byron Pickett, you know, Nicky Wimmer, the Cracker Brothers. I've sort of met a lot of sort of, you know, famous people along the way, and it was a good sort of experience. And, you know, it was great to be joined by them sorts of people, putting back into the community.
Mm. And being able to see kind of what right looks like, and like you said before, the role model that maybe they haven't seen in their life up to that point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's what I would like to be able to do, like be a role model to the community. You know, I've got Noongar in me, I've got Irish in me, so I've got, you know, the best of both worlds.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, I just want to put in wherever I can, because at the end of the day, no one knows what goes on with that kid's life yeah. behind closed doors. So, you know, if you can sort of reach the younger generation, because they're our future, you know what I mean? So if you distill good things in them, hopefully they will be great and they will grow up to know right from wrong and want to choose to go down into the right direction and, you know, have a good life.
Yeah.
A lot of achievements. You've done a lot in your life and those accomplishments are well recognised. What is there still left to do that you want to do?
Like, at the end of the day, I just want to be a role model, ambassador, a mentor for my community and, you know, for anyone that's in need of some help and, you know, some direction in life, because, you know, I've been there, I've done it, I can pass, you know, down a lot of knowledge, a lot of experience, and, you know, I've done a bit of everything, you know, Muay Thai, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, kickboxing, pro boxing, so, and I've learnt a lot about life, so, you know, being at my rock bottom and reaching, you know, world title, you know, Victorian middleweight boxing title and fighting for a World Boxing Federation title, you know, it's a feeling that, you know, not many people get to experience, because, you know, it's a hard gig, the fighting gig, you know, being punched around, being able to take a punch and come back when you're hurt, when you're feeling, you know, like garbage and doing well and winning a fight, you know, so... It's taught me a lot about myself and life.
What about life as a brickie? What have you learned as a brickie that's transferable into the ring?
Yeah, it's about commitment, hard work, dedication, and a lot of sacrifice. You know, you have to sacrifice a lot of things just to get that trade behind you. I remember when I was doing an apprenticeship, you know, beforehand, I was like, you know, throwing 500-600 bricks up to my boss. He was on a double story scaffold and I was throwing bricks up one at a time. And then basically I had a fight booked in for that night. So I went to my gym, to Fitzroy Stars back in the day, and I was trained by Dana Goodson. He trained like about 7 world champions, had about 30 Australian kickboxing champion, South Pacific. He had all these particular champions that he created and, he trained basically. And he even trained Lester the Blaster Ellis. He was a world boxing champion back in the day. So this guy had a repertoire of like, you know, Stars. Champions.
Yeah.
And I went to Fitzroy Stars one night, had a shower, then I went and fought, you know, at Knox Netball Stadium for 5 rounds, and I beat this guy on points, and I just threw up about 600-700 bricks beforehand, and I went in the ring and beat him. It was like, wow,
good warm up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Chris, you mentioned right at the start that very first fight, and you said, you know, how you felt before it, you know, that absolute sort of dry mouth. You said you were petrified. Did that ever completely leave you? Did you always have a bit of apprehension before going in the ring?
Yeah, it's good to have a bit of fear and a bit of nerves, like, in you. Like, it keeps you sort of more agile, more honest.
A bit sharper.
Yeah, a bit sharper, exactly. So, yeah, it's good to have nerves. It's a natural thing, you know, but you've just got to get in there, harness it in the right direction, you know, relax, you know, clear thoughts. Because if you start relaxing, you start thinking a bit clearer, you start punching quicker, you start kicking quicker, your reactions are a lot quicker if you relax. So there's a lot of things behind, you know, going in there and fighting. It's just not, you know, a sport where you jump in and you go in there and slug it out with someone, you know, tense, because you're going to wear yourself out. So I was always taught, like, fighting is like a game of physical chess. The best man with the best moves wins.
I think I've heard somewhere that courage is not the absence of fear, but it's the ability to get on with the job even when you have got a bit of fear. It sounds a similar sort of thing, that ability to calm yourself down, to not let that fear tighten you up into a ball, and to relax in spite of it.
Breathing and mindfulness, do you use any meditation, any breathing techniques as part of your training, as part of your routine?
Not really, but, you know, I've heard of, like, great fighters that meditate, and, you know, but, you know, what works for one person doesn't work for others, so you've just got to get in tune with what works for you and just run with that.
Do you visualise the fight before you step in the ring?
No, I don't like to look into it too much. I just go in there and have fun.
That doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun to me. But
what about any pre-match rituals? Do you have anything that you do before a fight, or you?
Nah, not really. Like, you know, I've actually knowing other fighters, like, some of them wear, like, their favourite old shirt that's, you know, looks like, you know, dog's breakfast, you know, and they actually have that in the warm-up period just to warm up, and then they sort of go out there and do the thing. So, yeah, different strokes for different folks or whatever sort of works for you, really.
Yeah, yeah.
You wear your lucky red undies, Ben.
Yeah.
The holy ones.
They were a different colour once I came out of the ring with you, mate.
I want to pull you up on that, Chris, because I watched a YouTube video where you fought Steve Dale. It was a kickboxing event. It was nighttime, and you wore a pair of silver sunglasses into the ring. Talk about those sunnies.
Yeah, that was not my doing. Did you see that big man next to me, Dana Goodson, the African-American dude? He, you know, requested me, Chris, you wear these glasses. So at the end of the day, I just do what I'm told.
And in 1999, this man became the first ever Aboriginal world kickboxing champion. He maintains a proud Aboriginal sporting tradition of such greats as Lionel Rose, Cathy Freeman. They call him the Aboriginal warrior, and tonight it is his dream time. It's Chris Collardhammer.
Well, just I'll pick my shots and stick to the game plan, basically. So, yeah, I'll just, like, do what Dana tells me to, like, follow every instruction that it gives me, really.
Match number two.
Sponsorship?
Yeah, not that. He just said, mate, you've just got to block out all the light, you know, just block out, you know, everything that's around you, because that was like a three-fight night event. So there was like eight different fighters from around Australia, New Zealand, and they were actually meeting in the ring for $10,000. So these guys were, you know, the cream of the crop fighters fighting for this money. And there was a lot of people there. It was a big venue, so, you know, you could feel, you know, the atmosphere. You know, you could cut it with a knife. That's how much atmosphere it was, like, whoa, you know. And, yeah, he just said, just block out everything, put these on, and, you know, do your thing.
And fast forward, the Aboriginal warrior, as you were termed, the Aboriginal warrior, got him with a short left.
Collard now stalking forward. Nice turning back kick to the midsection. A big overhand right. He gets him with the left. He gets him with the left. The Kiwi goes down. Steve Dale is down.
That was that short left.
It's all over. It's good night. Chris Collard moves through to the semi-final.
It was a short sort of night. I caught him with a beautiful punch, because usually the one that doesn't get seen catches you and, you know, takes you out. So, it was an early night for me. So it sort of lined up good, because then I sort of got out of the ring, I got to rest up easier, and I felt a bit more relaxed for the next fight, because I had two more fights after that fight. So yeah, it was a big night for me. I had to take a lot of injuries into each fight, so it was tough.
Into an arena of a different type. You like your Australian football. I think you're a West Coast Eagles supporter. And a dashing wingman for the Coburn Footy Club back in the day?
Yes, I was. I was, a footy player, and I loved Aussie rules. It was something that I sort of got into it. And now my son's playing juniors and he's doing really well. So
that's cool.
I'd love him to, go, as far as he possibly can with footy and just enjoy it and see what happens.
The West Coast Eagles have got some phenomenal Indigenous players in there at the moment. How do you feel when you watch the screen and see the likes of, a Rioli and a Lewis Jetta running around the field and representing proudly, amongst others, mind you?
Yeah, I'm just, blessed in a way to see that there's so many Indigenous people, on that pedestal now, and being role models for these younger kids that that need that role model to think, okay, this dude's playing AFL football, so I'm gonna go train up for football. And and if they do find the right path and they find the right people that can take them on this journey, well, that's half the battle.
And like you said before, even if the journey doesn't end up in the West Coast Eagles jersey, that discipline, that sort of commitment that you learn along the way can then transfer across into other areas.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, it's anything that you do in life, like, sacrifice, discipline, commitment, like whatever you want to do in life, you need them tools to do anything, to get a job, to go to uni, you got to commit yourself, you've got to put the hard yards in, because if you don't, you're not going to pass your exams, you're not going to get your degree. So, it's like anything in life, whatever you put into it, you'll get out of it.
Mm. All right. Let's give some hypotheticals. Hypothetically, on a pound-for-pound basis, if Chris Collard was to get in the ring with Danny Green, who would win?
Well, he's a good puncher, and he's sort of been in the boxing game for a lot longer than me, and he started off as an amateur, so he basically done his apprenticeship as an amateur, and he's a great fighter, so he'd probably beat me because of his experience. But if he jumped in the Muay Thai ring, <it'd be different.
laughs> split decision, the boxing ring. Is that a throwdown? Danny Green, Chris Collard.
I'm getting in the ring with neither of them.
Okay, what about Anthony Mundine?
Yeah, he's a very talented fighter. His hand speed and just him making that transition from rugby into like pro boxing. But I went over to the Mundine camp, and I was going to join the Mundine camp. And his father, Tony Mundine, he's a fantastic guy. He was a Commonwealth champion, and he was like a champion boxer back in the day. And he opened his arms and welcomed me in. And I was going to join the Mundine camp, but I was, sort of well set up in Melbourne, so I was a bit scared to go over that way. But, it was a great sort of experience that I seen, the way Anthony trained. And, I went and watched him fight in Wollongong that time. So I think he had maybe second, third fight, I think it was, and he beat the guy, very easily. His hand speed is just unbelievable.
Toughest fight?
I reckon Steve Skorvik would be right up there, because I hit him with everything, including the kitchen sink, and it just wouldn't go down. He was tough.
Shortest fight you've ever had?
I fought this guy when it was Australia versus England, the Ashes. I think I took this guy out in like about 30 seconds.
Is that rewarding, or is it a little frustrating that it's over that quickly?
Yeah, it's frustrating but rewarding in a sense, because, everything that you've worked hard for, and that fight just was so easy, and you've put the hard work in, so that's what opened the doors to make that fight easier.
Yeah.
Is you're fit, you're mentally prepared, you're good to go.
Favourite training exercise, if you could only do one thing, if you'd only make one recommendation to someone who wanted to do some boxing, what would it be? What would that training exercise be?
Running. You've got to put in the hard yards running. Like, I used to wake up like 5 o'clock in the morning, back when I was bricklaying, run 10Ks before work, go and lay bricks for 8 hours, and then go to my boxing gym and train for 2 hours with a sweat jacket, you know, cutting weight. So, you know, there's a lot of things that are behind the scenes that the average person don't see, the sacrifice, you know, training with a sweat jacket and cutting weight. And, you know, once you start cutting weight, you start getting angry, you start getting irritated, and, you know, you sort of take it out on your loved ones. You don't mean to, but, you know, you're sort of in a real hard situation because of what your body's going through.
Is that why you've never cut weight, Tim?
There's no sweat jacket big enough.
What about nutrition, Chris? Like, what importance in nutrition?
Yeah, I eat clean. So, you know, a lot of fruit, a lot of vegetables, a lot of chicken, you know, because it's easy to sort of process. And, you know, and fish as well. Fish is great. And, you know, taking multivitamins and fish oil tablets, and yeah, just, you know, doing the right thing by your body, because what they say, you know, your body is your temple. So, you know, what you put into it is what you get out of it. So, you know, you start eating healthy and doing the right thing by your body, you start getting results.
What about booze, mate? You mentioned right at the start there was a bit of alcoholism in your family as you were growing up and that sort of thing. Do you drink now? Do you, you know, both in terms of from a social perspective but also a fitness perspective? What are your thoughts?
No, I'm a non-sort of drinker. Sort of what I seen when I was younger, you know, it sort of turned me off it. And I did try it later on in life, but like Aboriginal people sort of, we've never been sort of integrated with alcohol in our life, so basically we can't process it as much as Anglo-Saxon, you know, because it's in the blood, so it's been, you know, passed down from generations and generations. That's why you've got like a lot of Aboriginals that get drunk and they get violent, because it's not part of their makeup, you know. So I sort of drank a couple of times, and, you know, I'd get irritated a bit easier than the next guy, because I suppose my upbringing, what I've seen and all that sort of stuff, when it was sort of in my system, it bring the worst out of me. So I just chose not to sort of go down that path with the alcohol. And plus, I wanted to be a role model for my kids, you know. Monkey sees, monkey does. And basically, you know, that's what it's about, putting back into my family.
Five kids at home, loving wife. How does home life now compare to your home growing up?
Oh, yeah. Like, I learned a lot about myself when I was younger, all the stuff that I didn't receive. And most importantly, I never received love from my mother. There's not one time where I can remember her telling me that she loved me. And, you know, to this day, it hurts still. And I just want to give that to my children. So, you know, I tell them that I love them. I embrace them, you know. I show everything that a loving father should show to his children.
Pretty good place to leave it, Chris. Mate, thank you very much for that. It's been absolutely cracking talking to you. Really appreciate your time and having a chat with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being here on your podcast. So thanks, guys, and have a good day.
Thanks, Chris, and good luck in September. We need to be ringside. Yeah.
Done.
Well, maybe you'll be in the ring. Never again. Well, Chris will be in the ring. Or maybe you might be on that card.
Yeah, I might be holding the card.
That's a ring girl.
I don't want to see that.
No one does. Chris, thanks, mate.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, thanks, boys.
Well, I bought into the township and we parked our car outside. I looked in through the window and I caught the publican's eye. It seems that we was welcome, but we must be sure our wares. So I fumbled through my paycheck to ensure we could prove our share. And as we breached the bar room of Her Majesty's Hotel, I tinkered with the beer mat as I settled for a spell. And we ordered a triple of pints all night and we danced like better stairs, singing, hold the line, hold the line.
I could see that there'd be trouble from the moment they arrived, with a thirst for some drinking and a pixie.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Now to the debrief. Here at the Unforgiving 60, we relentlessly pursue excellence, and so we'd love to get your feedback, any insights you might have, any reflections on what we've discussed. Certainly, if you are or if you know someone who's living a life less ordinary, we'd certainly love to hear from them as well. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. Of course, you can also follow us on social media. Just search up Unforgiving60, that's 60, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and give us a like on iTunes. Until next time we talk, we wish you all the best, and we certainly hope that what we've discussed can help you feel your own unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. Cheers. All you businessmen, politicians, get around and